Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
Hi, Emma. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Monique. It's so great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I am really happy to have you back because the first time you were here, you shared with us your first book, which is a memoir about your story, about what it was like to be adopted and adopted into a family where there was a lot of abuse and narcissistic parents. And you touched at, you kind of hinted on something about not a healthy relationship, but you didn't go into any detail with when you sought out help and support. And so this book that we're going to talk about today is, feels like really just as important. And it's the second big part of your story and also healing from it. So let me just say the first book was The Gathering Place, which is, what's the second part of the title? Because it's about adoption. The Gathering right. Place.
An adoptee story.
Right, right. So it really also helped me to understand more about what it's like and what could happen with what happens inside when you've been adopted and things that I really wasn't familiar with. And this book that we're going to be talking about, maybe you can tell us what it's called and why you wanted to write it.
Well, it's called A Fire is Coming, and it's very symbolic because the opening scene is about a fire that actually happened in 1993. And it is symbolic with a person that I met as a next door neighbor, and she was a therapist. And I asked her if I could have her, well, she handed me her business card and said, come see me. And so I had presenting symptoms of still being, having adoption angst, trying to figure out what it all meant. Why do I do some of the things I do? I had some marital problems. I had some infertility issues. And so there were a lot of those things that I felt that I wanted to ask her help with. And she was more than accommodating. And she was my next door neighbor. I knew nothing about therapy at that time of why that could be problematic of being, you know, right next door to your therapist. And I didn't understand when she'd start inviting me over to her house, why that was a bad idea. So the book goes into how that life experience that I had with my therapist went terribly wrong. And I want to educate other people about researching your therapist before you basically hand your life to them, because you have to get vulnerable. That's the name of the game in therapy. But make sure you're in a safe place. And so my whole book kind of reads like a psychological thriller. And it's a little bit like The Shrink Next Door, if you saw that on Netflix, where a therapist slowly and insidiously takes over a man's life because he's the therapist and convinces his client to give him everything. And my story is a little like that, and I'm trying to create awareness.
Yeah, I was really, as I was reading it, you know that I messaged you many times because I was just, you know, you could feel it because you can identify with being a survivor. And those of us who remember just when we start going out and realizing, okay, I'm going to find a therapist, I'm going to find someone, we're coming in with not a lot of understanding about safety, and some of us don't understand red flags yet. We're not there yet. That's why we're going for therapy. And so I was feeling all of that. And I think your story is so important. And I want to talk a little bit about it because of what, like what you said about the warning signs. And I know for me, when I first sought therapy, I just thought, and I know it sounds so silly now, but I just thought, oh, okay, well, if they have the degree, that means they're educated and I'm okay to go with them. Didn't matter what I felt inside. Didn't matter if anything seemed a little off. So let's talk about what your first experience was with her, because you were quite young. This was your first therapist. Did you feel yourself, was it hard to ask for help at the beginning?
Oh, I think it was terribly hard for me. It was only because we did have that face-to-face contact at our mailboxes and her handing me her psychologist card that it just kind of fell right into place of, well, could you help me? And I had no idea that it was really my relinquishment from youth, from birth and adoption and all of that was really driving my bus and making all my decisions. And it was another reason why I chose her, because a cult-like person, predator the way she was, she handed me exactly what I wanted on a silver platter, meaning that she knew that I was a hurt person. I had a tender spot, was my Achilles heel. And if it wasn't that, it was probably be something else. I'm not saying it happened to me just because I'm an adoptee, because I think a predator, they seek those that are unprotected. And she knew off the bat that she wanted me for her mate, not to give away too much of the story, but, and I was married, you know, at the time, and she even did some marital counseling between the two of us. And she would drive a wedge in our marriage to make it keep getting worse and worse and worse. So I just was so educated about what the whole therapeutic situation looks like and what red flag, what it even, you know, I ignored so many. In the book, I keep saying red flag, but there was also what she was offering me was more important to me than the red flag, meaning that she literally said the words, "I want to be the mother you never had." And she broke away down at my resistance to that, to where I finally embraced her as the mother I never had. And from that point, you know, she had agency over my whole life. But luckily, it was not for an extended amount of time. I've heard from others that had decades under the indoctrination of you know, someone. But luckily, mine was about a year. And it was long enough, believe me, because here at 29 years ago is when this happened. And I'm still talking about it, still recovering from it. I'll always be recovering from it.
Yeah, it's so important what you just mentioned about you felt something, but that gets overridden by almost a higher need that we have for the validation and to be seen by a mother figure. She used the word mother. I mean, you can just imagine if we've never had that. Well, you not imagine, you know, you know how that would just drive us there and ignore the red flags. And that, as you were speaking, it was making me think that I think that that happens with, sadly, probably with a lot of people, and not just like all kinds of relationships. We could ignore red flags because another need that we really, really have that's there pulls us in, that becomes higher. And again, there's, I know we may feel guilt about that, but it makes so much, so much sense. Yeah.
It's enough to disconnect our intuition. You know, things we normally on a normal basis would say, you know, that's absolutely not for me. But when your intuition is disconnected, and you have a master, a sociopathic master that knows how to do it, then that's where they gain control.
Yeah, my heart was really hurting for you when I was reading that, because, of course, knowing your history, having read the book before as well, but just, you know, any survivor that had that developmental trauma, you know, relational trauma, attachment, didn't have secure attachment, disorganized attachment, and then they find someone that has these open arms. It just makes so much sense. So, yeah. So what can you tell us about why you feel that people have to be really extra careful about whom they seek out? Is there anything you want to elaborate about that could be helpful for people?
Well, I would say the first thing is they have the permission to interview their therapist and make sure that what you think is, find out what their biases are. Maybe they say they're an adoptee competent therapist, but you need to ask them, what does that look like to you? And don't be afraid that if they give you some kind of defensive remark, well, that might be a red flag that it's not a good fit and that you should move on. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. And again, you know, coming from a place where growing up, not being allowed, not feeling like you had permission to ask questions, that can feel really scary. However, it's really important. And it's something that we can do, that we, it is something that I think therapists know, that you can ask questions about, like you said, I love it. You wanted to know their views about adoptees and what could they explain it to you? What does that mean? And looking out for red flags. That's really good. Yeah. So you talked about something that I didn't, maybe you can clarify. What, when you were talking about, you used the word cult hopper. What does that mean exactly to you?
Well, I think it ties right in with, if you come from a childhood where you were not able to have any kind of boundaries, if you came from a family that's authoritative, totalitarian, and rather cult-like, that was how I grew up. So that's what I thought relationship meant. That's what I thought love was. And so it was very distorted when I got out there and chose, a marriage partner or any kind of love relationship or any decision I would make. I just didn't even know I had the permission to say, I don't know if that's right for me or not. I didn't know I had the chance to explore and ask people, you know, what they thought on the issue and compare it to what I didn't know what I really thought, because I wasn't allowed to have a thought. It was that bad. So from there, I just jumped to a marriage where he was sociopathic in his own way of, he wanted to isolate me. He had a sense of entitlement. He had a narcissistic type personality, and he tried to cut me off from all my family and friends to where he was my guru, if you want to say it that way. And so it just wasn't a very big jump to go right to another relationship with, indoctrinated by my therapist, who was the same way. And just everything, the pattern just kept repeating itself until one day, you know, I was able to deconstruct, and it took a lot to get to that point, to deconstruct everything to where I'm no longer a cult hopper. And I have discovered my true self, which I don't think I met until about 7 years ago. I had no idea what my true self was.
Oh, that's so understandable for all of us. We can so relate. And we learn later on as we go along, you know, what is it that we like? What is it that we want? What's important to us? Yes, we can use our voice. Yes, we can state our opinion. But I wanted to just go back with something that I read in your book, and that stood out to me too. There were times when her persona, it kind of got distorted, and you talked about being, not distorted, but unveiled. And you started to see resemblances of how you were growing up, how you grew up, the relationship with your narcissistic caregiver.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about what was going on then and what you recall?
The way my therapist acted was she used all these covert hypnotic techniques of where she had the eye gaze, she'd speak a little slower, she'd be repetitive in her statements of what she wanted to drop into my head and get me to believe. And so I was mesmerized by all of these tactics. But once, I'm not going to tell too much about the story, but once I get really close to her and we are in relationship, she wasn't able to maintain her mask for any period of time anymore. And so the more the mask slipped, the more she resembled my narcissistic mother. And there were specific incidences and behaviors where they really started to match. And those scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
So luckily I got into a point where I got scared enough in one situation. It was enough. My adrenaline was flowing and I got away from her. But in the story, I even tell how psychologically I was still enmeshed with her, still felt I needed her for my survival. And it took a long, long time to break that. And I didn't have adequate therapy at that time to deprogram from a cultic situation, one-on-one abusive situation. I'm lucky that I guess I got enough where, you know, I did take her to court and all of that really helped validate that I was doing the right thing. So she couldn't do it to someone else.
Do you want to talk a bit about what it was like to report your psychologist? What was that? What was that whole thing like for you?
So hard. So hard, because I was still hearing her voice in my head, the therapist saying, "This, you know, this was all your fault. You know, you caused this to happen and you couldn't ever go report me because it would devastate me. It would crush me. It would take my license away. And I know you don't want to do that to me." I can't tell you, she pretty much started saying that from the first day of therapy on. So when I was faced with the idea that I did have a responsibility to report her, and I was hearing that from an attorney, a therapist, and my husband at the time, and I really resisted because I really truly felt that it was all my fault. And oddly enough, I still missed her. It was just kind of, it's hard to explain, but it was very psychological. So even then, when I did say, okay, I have an obligation to report her, and then to hear the Board of Ethics say, I don't know if we believe you or not. And, you know, you have to substantiate this. She doesn't have any other citations against her. So we feel like this is probably just a misunderstanding. And then it went on into a court case where the mediator was uneducated about the psychological effects of what a therapist does to, can have on their patient and the things they can get them to do that they normally would never have entertained doing. But even at the end of the day, even after he pretty much shamed me throughout the whole trial, which took years, I got a huge, a fairly large monetary award. Yeah, but it would never be enough to make up for what she's done.
Yeah, you talked about the shaming. You hear that so much from survivors when they go and they, you know, whether it's being a rape victim, but the shaming and the questioning. And as in your case, not doing like the research, it's just such a, like, it's hard to understand that that wouldn't be like a must. But I feel for you, like, after everything you went through, it almost feels like, okay, now I'm going to get my chance to tell my story and have them, you know, act like you're, it's not so bad, or you're making it up, or it's impossible. Look how great she is. She doesn't have anything else against her. What was it like making contact or eye contact with her? Did she?
That was
I'm
hard.
Laughing because you rolled your eyes. So
yeah, because she had it down. I mentioned the covert hypnotic techniques, and she had these eyeglasses where she would lower them and give a penetrating scare. She did that through the whole trial.
Oh my gosh.
I tried my best not to look her way, but there were times where it was unavoidable. And by then it was a few years down the road, but it was still like, I felt gross that mm-hmm. I felt she still had some tentacles in me.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me feel, I was hard on myself thinking, haven't you gotten out of this yet? You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that way about myself anymore, but at that time, that was my frame of mind mm-hmm. saying you should be farther along by now mm-hmm. and not let her affect you. But it was super hard. And you know what was even harder? Allowing another therapist to give me a session and for me to be vulnerable. I had to go to get well. I had to go to another therapist because she had, you know, exacerbated all the reasons I went in the first place and then added on all the additional ones that I had to start to try to solve and get through.
So
it took a long time.
You needed therapy from therapy.
Yep.
And then finding, you know, to trust someone. Hopefully the therapist that you found was, you trusted her.
Wasn't immediate, but down the road, there are two that are very, very, we have the, you know, upstanding rapport, and they're so ethical and so helpful. And I, it's been a great situation. So I'm a big proponent for therapy,
mm-hmm.
but I also want to say, please do your research, because there are predators everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they like positions where they have the differential of power.
Yeah.
That's just very, you know, attractive to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they are everywhere. Again, you know, we don't always think that they could be, you know, the doctor that you see,
yeah,
you know, the judge that you meet, the psychologist that you go to. So, yeah. Are there any other red flags that you can talk about in order to sort of prepare for looking for someone that feels safe that you can think
well,
about?
Well, if it ever feels like they're over-involved in your life, and they know too much about things outside of therapy,
mm-hmm.
or if they invite you over to their home or give you their phone number and say, call me night or day, or start talking too much about their own life, what their sexual preference is, who their mate is and what they're all about. And at one point she describes to me how her marriage is falling apart. That was in my therapy session. And the worst one that I can, I know these are all extreme cases, but she convinced me to be inside her therapy room when she was counseling someone else on the phone. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Like right there, privacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was,
yeah.
There's a lot of shame that I still have to work through and deconstruct.
Mm-hmm.
Because being a critical thinker now, that just wouldn't be something that I would allow. But like I said, they know how to disconnect your intuition. If they yeah. find an opening, a vulnerability within you, that can happen. And it doesn't even have to be as extreme as what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It could be just, you know, they keep you an hour and a half and your session's only an hour, or the, I don't know. There's a lot of red flags of,
mm-hmm.
They're not dropping in my head right at this moment.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I think the point is just to even have the curiosity, you know, to begin with, which is something that I don't think we may not necessarily have if we've never had experience with someone else that we are to be vulnerable with, that is a therapist, if we haven't had that in other safe relationships. So Yeah, I think it's so important to mention and to note. And it's interesting about, you know, the shame piece. I think, you know, it's not just in that area, but even in a lot of other places in our lives where we've made things that we wish done things or made choices that we wish we didn't do and feel shame about it. But everything that we do makes sense in the context of what we've experienced. And knowing that, I think, really diffuses the shame from a real compassionate and a biological, like neurobiological way. Like, it makes sense. And for that, I have a softening to it. And I hope that, you know, you'll see that too for yourself when you think about that, you know.
Absolutely. I've done a lot of work with EMDR and cognitive therapy and brain spotting and a lot of different things that have been really helpful to identify, deconstruct the story that I used to tell myself of who I am, and kind of give myself the question of who would you rather be? How do you want to show up? And so that's the way I approach my life now, that I don't have to have these labels on me, or I have choice now. And a lot of people, including, you know, from a relinquishment, I had no choice in that. No one asked me if I wanted to be adopted, and no choice in being adopted by the parents that didn't treat me very well. And so it just kind of goes on and on of, now I have choice. Now I can decide who I am and how I want to show up.
Yes, and you have choice on whether the therapist that you choose, whether she feels like a good fit for you. If not, you don't have to go with her or him. And
That's
you
right.
Also have the choice of when to stop therapy, when to start therapy, if you want to do therapy. Like, choice and agency for us is huge. It is so much a part of the healing journey. So I love that you recognize that and you're naming it. Yeah.
Well, as an adoptee, I'll say that we've always been the adaptable adoptee, meaning that in order to fit in, we've always felt as though we're taking up too much space, or we should apologize for even our existence. And that's just sort of the cult-like nature of being an adoptee, and the way the adoption industry likes to make people think that adoption is only good. There's no in between. You know, it's just black or white. And what adoptees are trying to voice now is that, yes, it can be great, but it's also a lot of other things that you, if you want to be a child center adoptive parent, then you want to think about what's best for your child. And if it means they need to know their birth parents, absolutely. If they need their birth records, absolutely. No more of the secret stuff. It just, you know, our secrets make us sick.
I agree. Secrets make us sick. Yeah, love that. So before we end, is there anything else you feel you want to share?
I can't think of anything right now, which is kind of odd, but
yeah,
I just feel so happy within writing my two memoirs, because it really helped therapeutically. It helped me in immeasurable ways. And if I could give any advice to anyone, whether they're an adoptee or you just have everyone has a story to tell. That's the bottom line. And love yourself enough to write your story, look at it and see how you can connect the dots of your own life. It's just immeasurable of what it can do for you and how you can find your joy and purpose in life.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, when you say that, because I think sometimes people might feel like, oh, but my story is painful. My story is hard. Why would I want to write that? I want to forget that. But you're talking about it from a place of connection, and I almost hear like empowerment and closure and all of those, and next and moving forward. Yeah.
To reconcile everything in order to raise to that next level of awareness to say, this is where I'm going now.
Yes, 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 yeah.
But I had
That's
to know my why. I had to know everything before that, not get stuck in it. But I needed to know it before I could evolve into something else.
Oh, I love that because I'm hearing that that moved you out of stuckness. So,
It did.
glad you wrote those two books, and it'll help the audience think about ways that they can, you know, whether it's writing a book or starting a podcast or,
Yeah.
you know, journaling, whatever it is, there a way to do that would be
absolutely so many ways.
Yeah.
Art therapy, music, walking,
yes.
Get an exercise routine. Oh, you're a kickboxer too, remember? Remember we share that love of kickboxing and yoga. I love yoga.
All right. All right. Well, thank you for today.
Thank you, Monique. I really appreciate it.